What's up, y'all? Welcome to class. This is Diseducation. My name is Mignon. I'm a Black non-binary teacher.
And I'm a Vietnamese American teacher named Quinn. Together, we are looking at what it's really like inside U.S. classrooms and schools through our eyes as teachers of color. In other words, what's happening behind closed classroom doors?
Because the reality is that U.S. education is burning, and students and teachers of color are the ones on fire. This is Diseducation.
The racism that you and I, Mignon, experienced fits squarely into the broken or leaky teacher diversity pipeline and the problem women of color in the workplace framework.
We've been telling you education is racist as fuck for students and for teachers. If people only want to acknowledge racism when there's an online hashtag or a dead body or a multi-city protest, then they have missed the fucking plot. And the reality is that the vast majority of racism experienced by teachers of color does not get investigated, does not get confirmed by HR. There are no repercussions for the people committing it, and there's no restoration for those of us who experienced it. That doesn't make that racism less real. That doesn't mean that white supremacy isn't working and moving and conniving and destroying. When we stood up for students, stood up against white supremacy, people viewed us as a problem. But teachers of color supporting students, which often means fighting against racism, is not the problem. White supremacy is.
You and I, Mignon, know that our experience is not unique. We are not alone. While there has been plenty of research indicating high teacher of color attrition, there hasn't been much study as to how and why. That's why we created this series. By breaking down and analyzing our story, we are identifying consistent patterns that push teachers of color out.
These patterns align with those uncovered in a recent study published in November of 2023 called Small But Mighty, which explored why Black teachers were leaving their jobs more than white teachers in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania. This study was conducted by Research for Action, RFA, which is an educational research nonprofit focused on racial and social justice. For this study on Black teacher attrition and retention, RFA interviewed Black teachers in Allegheny County about their experiences. Our series and RFA's research have highlighted the major realities facing teachers of color. Things like racial microaggressions, harm caused by white colleagues, unjust treatment and retaliation from white district and school administrators, heavier workloads, and racism towards students.
We know that racism in the educational workplace is real. We also know, however, that stories like ours are often discounted and dismissed. That's why RFA's research is important. That's why platforming the voices of teachers of color is important. In this episode, you will hear from three teachers of color about their time in education and what drove them from their district or the classroom altogether.
We are talking to teachers from the East Coast, West Coast, and Midwest, spanning elementary, middle, and high school. Teacher M is a Filipino-American high school English teacher who has worked in San Francisco Bay Area schools for more than 10 years. When we spoke to Teacher M, he described his own racialized experience in education.
And what they hired me under, though, was like there was this pretense where it was like, we're all about racial equity and like justice and like disrupting like the patriarchy and disrupting like capitalism, right? And to me, in my eyes, as that teacher, I was like, that is exactly what I want to do. I get to the department, only person of color. And I'm the youngest by like 30 years. And it was just kind of crazy. Like I'm there with like 70-year-old people, right? All the entire department. Entire department's like 70-year-old white dudes. I'm there and I'm like, oh, hey, bro, you want to collaborate? Let's please do this. Like, I'm new to this community. Like, you've been here for obviously a long time. Like, help me out. Let me get in. Let me help. Let me at least help me. Shunned me. And for the longest time, I thought I wasn't worth it. And I looked at like, you know, I've been only teaching for this long. They've been here for like seven times as much or whatever, right? I'm bad at math, so I'm like hyperbolic. But no one like reached out. So I was like, okay, What's the issue here?
When Teacher M first joined this district, the school branded itself as being about justice, being about equity. But as time went on, he saw the realities of working there, that racism had been greenwashed and he was being isolated and excluded. As time went on, he found himself overworked and overburdened, taxed with labor that other teachers weren't facing at this large school.
The first time I worked, it was like 4,000 kids, right? It's like huge. So they had reading intervention teachers, and a lot of that fell on me because I was an English teacher. Because the reading intervention teachers were not just that. They were like, you know, like the, what would I call it? Like just like the academic support teachers, right? So when they couldn't figure stuff out, I had to do it, right? And then later, pandemic happens, right? So I was there for 3 years, right? First off, everyone, all the teachers at the school were like, we don't know how to do this. And all the parents were like, you guys are such like heroes. You need to be recognized for all things you do because, you know, we have our kids at home now and that's kind of crazy. Like, I don't know how y'all do that. But yeah, fast forward to today, I mean, it's like, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that I feel like so many teachers had that experience. So everyone was like, wait a minute, this is what y'all were dealing with?
Bro, and then though, fast forward to like literally 6 months later, right? Like not even like a year, right? 6 months later, the parents are at the school board meetings, like complaining of like, we need to have our kids like back in schools for whatever reason they believe. I could see it one way. I also see what they're saying. Fine, that's legit. So when they decide to bring back kids to that school, they ask me, right? We're gonna ask you, like, can you do this ELD program over summer? I was like, I'm not sure if I'm okay with that because my wife was like immunocompromised. I was like, I'm not sure if I'm okay with that, right? Like, there's problems. They're like, well, you know, we're gonna pay you this much or whatever, and also, you know, like, you're gonna be someone that the district's gonna look to. And I was like, okay, fuck all that, right? I do it, and everyone was like, they bring like the entire ELD community to my school. Not just my students, the entire community in my school, like from that entire district, right, to my school, over like to try the in-person class thing. It was literally ELD, and I mean that 187%, like more so than 137%. Like I mean that. So at the time, I will say this, like I'm not like implying malicious intent on their end, like I'm not. What I will say, though, it could be perceived certainly that way from my end now. And then when I thought about it, I was like, you know, that's kind of like really fucked up, you know? And that was nothing what they wanted in the first place. Like, I'm Filipino, young, you know what I'm saying? I'm in this school, and they were like, oh, and they were like, if I may throw out earlier, you guys had talked about like when you guys were like in the school in which you were, and they're asking you to do things that are about your demographic without you even asking to do that.
We asked Teacher M if he felt if his choice was voluntary.
My wife was in law school for the first year, right? Like I got this high paid position at the school because they were paying me a lot. It's like, okay, in order to keep afloat, yes, we'll do it. And we agreed to that. But I don't think I had a choice because if I had said no, I think I would have been nixed immediately. Like, you know, like I was the first, second year teacher there when they were asking me to do these things, right? Like, how could I say no? Because if I had said no, they could just easily get rid of me. Yeah, it felt, in a nutshell, shitty. Like, it felt gross. Like, it grimy and, like, exploitative. Like, it did feel that way, right? And, again, to belabor this point, like, I don't feel like I had a choice. Like, it was only because, like, I mean, it's like, I was the only person of color there at the school. And so there's kind of, like, a bifurcated duty, right? Where it's like, I want to do right by the kids who are there who also don't see people of color, right? I also want to do right by the district. Like, I believe in teaching. And when I think about it now, like, I end up leaving because of that experience. I was like, okay, this is like, and it's hard to say, like, the job doesn't equate my life, you know? And which is kind of shitty for me to say because I really believe, like, I love my job. That's like my identity, you know, which is for better or worse, but it is. When I look at it in retrospect, it's like, oh my goodness. Like I really was a pawn in their chess game, right? for like virtue signaling or like getting through the pandemic. When I got tenured, I left. That was the thing. I was like, done. I did your shit. I'm out. You know, it's like maybe I'm proving a point that I'm putting in their mouths. But at the same time, to me, it's like I still dealt with it fine. And, you know, like I feel better because of it. And also I still feel like psychically traumatized with working in an area that has just to say like a lot of money that messes me up. Like I'm dubious about their intents.
Knowing that he is still teaching, we asked Teacher M if he would ever return to that school district where he had tenure.
Would I ever go back? No, definitely not.
Across the country in Philadelphia, a Black elementary school teacher saw many of these same racialized patterns showing up in her school that pushed her out of the career 2 years ago. We met Teacher Jones through Research for Action, the nonprofit we mentioned focused on equity and improved opportunities for underserved students and their families. Teacher Jones spoke to us about her 6 years in the classroom.
So the school I worked at, an urban area, I guess that's the official term for Title I school. It was like 99% African-American student population. The teachers, my first year, it seemed like there were more white teachers than Black teachers, which I thought was odd because it didn't match like the demographic. The last few years I was there, it was a Black male principal and a Black female vice principal. Yeah, my first year, I was teaching second grade. I love second grade. That is my bread and butter. And I was with them for a month, and I was pulled into the office, and I thought I was being fired, and I was very scared. And I had also told my mom, like, I feel like they're watching me. And literally the first thing that came out of the principal's mouth is, we've been watching you, and we think that you would be good in this fourth grade class. And I cried right in the office because this was a class that, you know, when you walk by it, you would, you know, collect yourself because it was like, oh God. I mean, kids were down on the floors fighting with teachers, literally. Teachers didn't want to even cover the class for a period. And so now here I am, first year teacher, I'm being given this class because their teacher quit like a week into the school year because it was too hard for her. She was a white teacher. And she just quit on a random Tuesday. And so now I'm having to take on whatever it is that she was dealing with. Fortunately, I do have good classroom management. How and why, I don't know. I do think that it is kind of something that's innate and just something that's part of it is just kind of in me. But I had to take that class and it wound up being really good for me. However, to have all second grade curriculum, I've decorated my room to fit, you know, 7 and 8 year olds. And so now I'm having to deal with a whole new curriculum. And also I'm a first year teacher and they've already missed a month of school basically because they've been having subs and, you know, being covered by teachers. So again, a Black woman having to come in, you know, save the day because, you know, she could handle it.
Changing grade levels requires a lot of work. New standards, new curriculum, new room. We asked what kind of time Teacher Jones had to prepare.
I was given a few days. I don't think it was like a full school week, but I was given a few days.
Like Teacher M, Teacher Jones was burdened with extra labor as a teacher of color by school admin, principals, and vice principals. That was her reality as a first year in the classroom. As time went on, Teacher Jones began to see more and more how admin operated behind the scenes.
I've witnessed principals saying the most disgusting things to children. I've witnessed principals bully staff, yelling at them in front of their children, whether it was pulling them out of their classrooms to yell at them, doing observations just to be retaliatory because maybe someone reported something to someone higher up, or maybe they reported something to a union.
This kind of retaliation and bullying was par for the course at the school. Teacher Jones remembers another incident when students faced similar treatment from admin.
So we're at breakfast. The principal asked for, like, everybody to be quiet. I believe we were about to, like, dismiss soon. And a little girl in my class, I believe she just leaned over and whispered to the girl next to her, nothing major. And he came over to her and he just lit into her and he yelled at her and was like, this is why no one likes you and you don't have any friends. And this is in front of the entire lunchroom. And I think it's like grades maybe like 1 to 3 or 4 in there. And it's like maybe 2 to 3 classes per grade. And I spent a good amount of my morning having a conversation with her and consoling her because she's just been embarrassed by someone who is supposed to take care of her. Like, her parents dropped her off. So essentially, she is in our care. So it is up to us to make sure that she is taken care of emotionally, mentally, physically. Like, she's supposed to be safe here. And so I spent a lot of my morning just saying to her, like, you know, do you have friends? Yes, you do. Do your friends love you? Yes, they do. Does Miss Jones love you? Yes. You know, do we know this man? No, because we didn't really know him. He was new to the school. And basically, like, helping her navigate through that, because this is an adult. And so often we're told as kids, like, you know, adults are the all-knowing beings, and children put a lot of stock into what adults say. And even though children may not have the vocabulary to articulate how things are making them feel, they internalize a lot of that stuff. And so that happened like 2019, and I haven't forgotten it. And it didn't happen to me. So I know for sure that she hasn't forgotten it either. And I know at one point the district came in, I think that was my first year, and they did like a culture audit of sorts because things had gotten so bad. But I think it's important for people to really investigate the leaders at your schools. Look up the teachers, find out about the teachers, because sometimes people are in positions and they do not care about these children. And it's really unfortunate. And when you have people in leadership positions who do not take care of children in the way that they should, and you have teachers who that's all that their focus is, it really creates this dynamic of constantly like butting heads and constant, you know, pushback, because they're making decisions that's not in the best interest of children.
White supremacy infects everything, and teachers and admin of color are not exempt from that. It's no surprise that when admin belittle staff and students of color, school culture suffers. Teacher Jones saw firsthand the damage school culture can cause when its leaders are not operating from an actively anti-racist mindset.
So we're coming up on Black History Month, okay? For me, it's Black History all year. Like, we're all Black in here, so why wouldn't it be? But this particular February, admin decided that each floor would be a different time period.
What time periods are we talking about here?
So I think like the first floor was going to be like, I don't know, like 2000s or something. You know, fine. That's fine. The second floor, I can't remember. But that third floor, where the older children are, they wanted it to be like 1700s, 1800s. And the remark made was, I wanted to look like slavery up there. In the middle of COVID, post-COVID, where people are dying and we have limited access to joy, you want Black students to create an atmosphere that looks like and feels like slavery? Are y'all insane?
They've lost the plot.
That's wild. Oh my gosh.
I don't even have words.
So please tell me this teaching staff was unified on this is a batshit idea.
I was unified that this was, I don't care about what nobody else is doing. I'm telling you what I'm not doing. I don't think they actually did it, but because they had a lot of stuff going on that third floor. But yeah, that was the proposal. That was the statement made. Why do you want it to look and feel like slave? Like, why? And this is Black admin. So, you know, sometimes, even though there are Black admin serving Black students, they are still shepherds of white supremacy. They're carrying the banner of white supremacy. They're doing things that you wouldn't think that someone who looks like you would be interested in.
We asked Teacher Jones how she responded to these kinds of racist moments and other issues facing students and staff. And she reflected on what it was like speaking up.
In the background, I have white teachers texting me, you know, first we have a meeting because we were a part of a union. So we have meetings. Everybody's voicing their concerns. People may cry because, you know, these things are happening, whether it's needing to advocate for ourselves or for policies that are hurtful to children. And so we would have these meetings and we would come up with these solutions. And I was a building rep. I'm also very comfortable in the education environment, so I don't mind speaking up. And so what would happen is we would have meetings after that with like admin or whatever, and I would speak up. Literally as I'm talking, my phone would be buzzing and I would have teachers texting me, I agree with you, Jones. I'm with you, Jones. And they wouldn't say anything. And so what happens is if you are a Black teacher who speaks up about things, you then are labeled a problem. And it wasn't just me. There was a group of us Black teachers who were labeled problems. And were we actually problems? No, it's just that we pushed back on things that we didn't think were right.
So Jones, why did you leave?
I was tired of fighting. That's ultimately what it came down to. And unfortunately, the education profession is extremely toxic. And I mean in terms of not taking care of yourself and putting, yes, the kids are important, but you come first. You know, the saying, you can't pour from an empty cup. And that is what I was trying to do. And it just was not working. I got sick mentally, physically. I just didn't have it. I thought that, because at first I thought, oh, well, maybe if I go to a different school or maybe if I go to a different district. But I got to a point where the district has more Black students in it than any other population. And the decisions that are made that go against their best interests, the lack of support, the lack of supplies, the lack of basic things, again, going back to something as simple as air conditioning. It's kind of sinister to know that there's an overwhelming majority of Black students and they're not being treated well. And so for me, it was like, me going to a different school is not going to change this. Me going to a different district, I may experience something else. Maybe if I went out to the suburb, but I'm going to come into a different set of problems because now I'm going to be dealing with a different demographic of students and parents. So to me, it just seemed like it's a bigger issue than just, you know, my school, my district. It's a structural thing. And until those things are dismantled, it's not going to change. And so in good faith, I just couldn't be a part of it anymore. I am a first generation, you know, college graduate. And so, and teaching is, as much as it's undervalued, it's seen as like this, like you have some esteem with it, you know, when someone asks you what you do, you go, you're a teacher. They're like, oh, wow. You know, it's a big deal. And, you know, my family, they're proud of that. And so I had to think about that. Thinking about me losing the relationships and the connections that I had with teachers, wondering if are these genuine relationships or are we trauma bonding? And what will that relationship look like once I leave? It was just a lot of deconstructing me, you know, do I not really care about these children if I'm deciding to put myself first? What am I going to do after this? will I be able to take care of myself? Like me leaving teaching, like I blew up my life, but I do feel like in the best way. And that was a lesson in me walking away from things that no longer serve me. And I think that's important no matter what profession you're in, or if it's a relationship or whatever the case may be. If it's no longer serving you, if it's causing you harm, which teaching was causing me harm, I gotta go.
Inequitable burden, racist school culture and admin. These are just a few reasons Teacher Jones identified that led to her leaving the profession. What could have made her stay?
I would have needed space to push back and to have people in charge that are not, how can I say this? I mean, just open. Like, it's not a criticism of you specifically, or, you know, something against you specifically. This is bigger than us. This is about these kids. And I would have needed a more student-focused leadership. So I think just having, like, leadership who understands that, yes, the kids are important, but the teachers are important also.
Wanted to see if the experiences of teachers of color were matching up across the country. Teacher M on the West Coast, Teacher Jones on the East. We next spoke to Ania Ray Nicole, a Black teacher from Minneapolis, Minnesota. She talked to us about the lack of transparency and accountability concerning teacher attrition and the culture of low expectations for students of color she saw as a middle school English teacher.
Yeah, our student body was predominantly Black. We did have a large or sizable Asian community there. We had Latino kids. We had a lot of kids who were coming in as immigrants. So we were diverse on paper. And then I would say our staff was not reflective of that. My first year, we did have more Black support staff. And then after that first year, there was a large exodus of Black educators who left. Our staff did not reflect our student body, which I think is so often what we see in public education. One of the questions I was intentional about asking as they were, you know, recruiting me was, if you are recruiting a Black educator in this space, what are you bringing us into? And what are y'all doing to ensure that we stay? And so the principal, he had let me know, he's like, I'm going to be really frank with you. We talk about justice, we talk about these things, but you are still going to be probably one of the few people of color in our workshops. There's still going to be a lot of white folks who are doing it wrong. And I think his honesty is what I really appreciated, is that he wasn't sugarcoating the fact that we have this language, but it's not always going to look like that. So I was like, okay, as long as you're honest, I can work from that space. But the school itself did not model those values. One thing that comes to mind, I think I spoke of the exodus of Black staff members who had left, and it was particularly Black women, and some of them I had known even before going into the school. And so as they left, there was no addressing the why behind it. It was kind of like, okay, they're leaving. I'm disappointed that no one really addressed that exodus of Black women leaving. I think it was safe to just be like, oh, they didn't want to work here anymore. And that should have been my warning. It's like, if they're leaving, then there's something terrible happening within the culture that's causing us to not want to stay around.
Ania was seeing major red flags, high teacher turnover, lack of commitment to justice, and not surprisingly, different and damaging lower expectations for students of color.
overall, I saw a lack of justice in the way that kids weren't held accountable for anything. And I would say like 70%, maybe 60% of the students weren't attending classes. They were all in the hallway. Either in the hallway, some of them were fighting or getting in trouble with things. And I would see hall monitors kind of walk by and say, hey, Mike, tell them to get to class, and then they'll turn the other cheek. Or I see staff who will see them, you know, dab up with them, say, hey, weren't you in class? And then they keep it moving. And to me, that was my red flag, is that we've created a culture where it is okay for such a large percentage of our students to not be in their classroom spaces. And y'all have affirmed that by not having any systems to encourage them to get back into the classroom or to change how teachers are teaching so that kids want to be there. And for me, I'm like, y'all don't believe our kids can succeed. You don't believe our kids are smart or capable. And I see that because you are not encouraging them to walk into what their abilities are. And so it was kind of this passive attitude of like, that kid's just bad. He could just stay out here. But it's hard to call it racist because it's like, they're not hurting that child on the surface, but long-term you are hurting that child. And the difference between some of me and my white colleagues is like, I know the banter with kids. I know how their parents are speaking to them. There's something within our community, how we hold kids accountable. It's like, baby, this is going to hurt, but I need you to get up and try again. And it's stern, but it's still coming from a place of love. And if I love you, I believe that you can become something. I believe that you have a future possibility. But if I don't love you, I'm just going to push you away and let you fail. But for them, they're like, this kid said I'm their best friend, so this must mean I'm doing something right. Kids have enough friends. Like, kids have enough friends, but do they have enough loving adults who are going to stand on business? And that's what the kids say now, stand on business. And I don't think they do. I had an assistant principal who came in. She was just an intern, I believe. And she was a fellow Black woman as well. And she said the culture of just low expectations for our babies was difficult for her also to witness. So to have another Black woman name what I was seeing, I needed that. Because at first I was like, maybe this is normal. Maybe this is just what public school systems are. But no, I think it's just not believing our kids can succeed, and therefore we aren't holding them to anything.
Ania talked about being one of the only people in the building holding students accountable and holding space for students. We asked her what it felt like taking on that kind of responsibility.
There's a different burden that I had to carry in that school for our children. There was a way that I felt like I wasn't properly supported. I struggled building community with my colleagues. I had a few folks that I felt, you know, close to, but it just felt so hard to break ground in that building as a Black woman. I also was thoroughly traumatized my own self. And I can't remember if this was the first or second year, but second week of teaching, that's when we get notice about Breonna Taylor and the verdict with the police officers. So I was coming in still grieving and recognizing that my students were also grieving. So I didn't have the luxury to just teach English. I had to be a counselor. I had to be a therapist, sometimes a preacher when it was necessary, a place of resource. I remember paying some of my kids' phone bills and trying to get them jackets because they didn't have some of those things. And so thinking about my other colleagues who were also probably going through it, I'm not sure if they had the same experience, though. I don't know if that labor was put on me or if I put it on myself. It's hard to separate the two. I would say there was a different sort of emotional labor when it came to dealing with kids who've been traumatized by our education system. And so I know kids might come to my classroom or share certain experiences that they were having with their white teachers that they didn't like. And so I felt like I did have to take a lot of spillage from other classroom spaces into my own, because students had a certain trust in me as I belonged to the same community that they did. I was really, really intentional about not allowing other people to put labor into me, because I heard from other educators of color, like they were expected to be the disciplinary. They were expected to do X amount of things. And so there's times where I had to shut my door or have to make it clear, like, I'm not going to be the savior of the children. One, that's not my job. And two, none of that load should fall onto teachers of color, because then when we leave, who's holding that harm when this should all be held by all of us? I have moments where I started to have intense anxiety about work, and I started to have intense depression at work. And that would look like in the middle of the night, I would be hyperventilating. I had moments where I was crying before even leaving my door. And so I started to notice my mental health was deteriorating. I was angry a lot. I think once I noticed my behavior was spilling into my classroom, that's when I was like, okay, this no longer suits me. I don't want to harm a child because I'm grieving this system. This is no longer the space. It was no longer the space for me. And I had that same assistant principal who ended up leaving. I remember I had a conversation with her and she just said, pray about it. She is like, ask God how long he wants you in this space. And ask if he doesn't want you there, then where do you need to go? And I remember the first year I prayed about it, I didn't feel like it was time for me to leave. That second year, I think that was confirmation, like, now it's time for you to go. I have to heal before I can even go back into education. And I think it's important to note that, like, I went from George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Breonna Taylor happened before George Floyd. And then we had an incident within our own community in Brooklyn Center. And I can't remember the young man's name. I believe it was Dante Wright, who was also murdered in the community that my kids live in. And so for white teachers, it's easier to kind of absorb it and keep it moving because you go back to your white family and your community that's separated. But I still live in this community and I can't remove myself. And after just back-to-back deaths and murders, I was like, I haven't healed from this. I haven't been given time to grieve because I'm having to be a counselor and a therapist to children who are also grieving. And to, you know, broken folks, like, y'all aren't really going to be healing or helping each other. And I'm glad I was removed. I feel so much better. And I'm not sure when I'll be called back to teaching. But I think biggest thing is when my mental health was deteriorating, it's time to go. When I was dreading work. And then when my emotions were spilling in my classroom, that kind of summed it up for me. And so it was exhausting. That's what I would say. To constantly be in conflict with the space that I was working in. But isn't that what it's like to be Black? Like, constantly be in conflict with the world? And let me tell you some of the biggest words that stuck out to me from a fellow educator. She's an elder. And when I told her I was going into teaching, she said, congratulations and condolences to you.
Thank you. So often, teachers of color don't talk about their experiences in the classroom because of fear of repercussions and the trauma of reliving those memories. We want to thank those who've been willing to speak out. We are so grateful and honored to hear their stories. Their time in the classroom feels so similar to our own experiences. Mignon, what commonalities do you see among all of our stories?
Let's take it back to the problem women of color in the workplace framework we've been talking about all series long. In episode one, we mentioned the kind of greenwashing of racism that you and I faced, Quinn. Teacher M described something very similar, where the school presented itself as all rah-rah, DEI, Jedi, very liberal.
Is this a Bay Area thing?
I think it must be. But ultimately, the truth will out.
Meanwhile, Ania talked about how the principal who hired her tried to be transparent, but somehow the exodus of Black teachers went completely unmentioned and unaddressed.
When we were hired, our school, like Teacher M's story, talked a good game. They made it seem like they'd been revamping the Capital P project we mentioned in episodes 5, 6, and 7. And they said they'd been revamping it over the last decade as proof of the kind of progressive and anti-racist collaboration that this school was doing. It wasn't until we left that we found out this project had students debating Confederate flags or statues only 3 years before we arrived.
Just to put this in context, I was teaching seniors my first year who participated in these debates as freshmen. Teacher M, Ania, and you and I, Mignon, faced some real dishonesty about the type of schools we were stepping into. I get it. It's part of the hiring process. Employers have to market themselves to candidates. But when it comes to teachers of color, this kind of masking of the realities of a school ends up becoming lethal for teachers of color. Another commonality we see running through everyone's stories is the inequitable labor and unique exploitation teachers of color face compared to white colleagues. In episode 3, we talked about this obvious phenomenon, specifically the burdens around racialized curriculum building, relationship building, and educating colleagues. Like us, Ania, too, was tasked with providing emotional support to students of color, while white coworkers did not share this responsibility the same way. Teacher M was tasked with providing in-person instruction while the rest of the district stayed safe at home during COVID. And Teacher Jones was tasked with taking over an abandoned and challenging class in the middle of her first year with no support and almost no prep time.
Research for Action, RFA, the education research org we mentioned earlier, identified this kind of inequitable labor as a primary challenge facing Black teachers. One of the teachers interviewed for the study stated, "Anytime there's a problem, we're expected to fix it. None of that is pushed onto white colleagues. They're getting the same paycheck I'm getting, but they're doing less work and have to deal with less issues. And they're supported in a way that is really biased, and it's seen by everyone. We believe this is one of the reasons teachers of color leave the profession."
Mignon, what other patterns do you see?
Racist school cultures that carry low expectations for students of color. Mm-hmm. Ania talks about this. The way that so many white teachers conflate friendliness with relationship building and fail to focus on accountability and academic support as care, aka standing on business. RFA noted the impact of this on Black teachers, writing, "These teachers shared that they have been disappointed and disillusioned by white teachers' lack of respect for Black children and by their unwillingness to maintain high expectations for Black students, to help them feel empowered and heard, or to support them in succeeding academically."
We talk about this culture of low expectations in our episode 2, Mignon. Our focus as teachers is never to be liked by our students, but to support them academically, to give them all the tools and resources they need to excel. Positive relationships with students are forged from that place.
And low expectations, that's just one part of school culture. But racist school culture comes in all forms. When Teacher Jones talked about the slavery floor at her school, I almost lost it. Slavery? You know, and it came from Black admin.
Wild. I mean, imagine what white admin is doing.
And while this is an extremely stark example of school culture gone wrong, the reality is that racist school culture makes schools unsafe for students and staff of color.
You might wonder, how does racist school culture make schools unsafe? Because they build an environment where teachers think racist behavior is okay, where they think racist behavior isn't even racist in the first place.
RFA talked about the impact of this kind of interpersonal racism in the Small But Mighty study, writing, many Black teachers expressed that poor relationships with their colleagues added frustration to their experiences as teachers. In episodes 5, 6, and 7, Quinn, you and I detail how our white coworkers' racist behavior toward us disrupted collaboration and relationships. One of the ways our coworkers targeted us was through relational bullying, which we talked about in episode 8. Teacher Jones mentioned the same thing. She was excessively monitored and even had her pay illegally docked. We also faced retaliation when a coworker attempted to conduct a white vigilante investigation of our teaching.
She thought she was a bad girl or something.
She's like, she was wearing some kind of mask. Teachers interviewed by RFA described a need to watch their back around their white peers, as in a few cases, their white colleagues have attempted to have Black teachers fired. That feels eerily familiar.
And the thing is, when you examine our story, when you examine Teacher Jones's story, it becomes apparent that this kind of retaliation was so often a knee-jerk reaction from institutions and individuals when a teacher of color dared to advocate for students.
RFA saw this in their research too. They concluded in their study that these punitive actions were sometimes carried out in response to Black teachers sharing criticisms or feedback about administrative or school policies, speaking out about their experiences, or advocating for racial equity. Not only did RFA's study uncover these kinds of retaliatory practices, they also gleaned how many of these teachers articulated an understanding of both the systemic nature of anti-Black racism in their districts or LEAs and the interpersonal racism experienced by teachers and by students.
But the hardest part of all, for me, for you, for each of the teachers we talked to, was having to witness adults harm children day in and day out. That shit is trauma.
It's a sentiment shared by a Black teacher RFA interviewed, who said that the reason they left education was because they did not want to be complicit in a system that's not serving children.
This quote asks several questions you and I have constantly wrestled with throughout our careers in education. Can teachers avoid upholding racism if they are part of inherently racist institutions? Is it possible for teachers to not harm students if they choose to stay? Can an individual outwork a system?
So where does this leave us? We've shown you what's happening behind closed classroom doors, because before we can solve a problem, we have to understand it. We've taken you inside the last stage of the broken or leaky teacher diversity pipeline. We've detailed for you the acute harm that pushes teachers of color out of education.
Armed with this information, we ask all of you, teachers, admin, parents, professionals, and students, what will you choose to do?